A specter is haunting the world.
The specter of communism.
I would say, in answer to your question, that the contradiction is more apparent than real. I would say that it is a seeming contradiction, because the question is put in a way that is abstract and that is divorced from the larger struggles in the country. Take, for example, the way you put the question. You recall the immediate period after the close of the war. That's a very important period in the history of struggle for democracy in this country. The problem that presented itself at that time consisted in the struggle with mixed class forces in the country, expressed in the form of the United Front, to defeat fascism, to stop on a world scale the Rome, Berlin, Tokyo Acts. At home, to defeat the efforts of the America Firsters, to defeat the National Association of Manufacturers, to defeat the sit-down of big capital a la Henry Ford, and to defeat the Ku Klux Klan and other reactionary forces in the country. There was a common interest existing between all of these class forces who had as a single aim to defeat fascism, not to retreat a single inch from maintaining what masses has achieved in blood for this country. Naturally, under such circumstances, there was an activization of all democratic forces. The communists, who sincerely devote themselves to the struggle for democracy and see socialism only in relationship to it, was activized as well. There's not a group in the country which did not grow as a result of fighting for democracy. And people felt freedom to give their true feelings to the communists who they saw on the firing line for democracy and anti-fascism. Now, after the victory had been achieved, then these same mixed class forces find themselves in a situation where there takes place a differentiation among them. Some want to stand still, some wish to go back, and many of them all want communists not to profit from their victory to which they gave so much. The nature of the struggle is different. This does not mean that the popularity, as you put it, although we are in more than a popularity contest, but I accept that language. This does not mean that the Communist Party is any less popular among the great masses. It does mean that what has come into the picture has been a new kind of unity against sectors of the United Front which participated in the common front against fascism. But now it was turned against the communists, lest their popularity continues to increase.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Spectre podcast. This is Dante here, again back with another special episode. And today's episode will be featuring Tony Pesanovsky, who was the president of the St. Louis Workers' Education Society, a 501c3 nonprofit organization chartered by the St. Louis Central Labor Council as a worker center. He also writes many articles in the People's World, the St. Louis Labor Tribune, AlterNet, Shelter Force, Political Affairs, and Z Magazine. And he is the author of a new book, 100th Year Anniversary Founding of the Communist Party USA. The book is called Let Them Tremble, Biographical Interventions Marking 100 Years of the Communist Party USA. And he's been giving a speaking tour across the country these past few months. And today's speaking tour was held at Iowa in this past Black History Month in February. And he was giving a talk about one of the biographical figures in his book. And the figure is Henry Winston, a former chairperson of the CPUSA, who was imprisoned under the Smith Act and lost his eyesight due to his imprisonment and neglect from prison guards in the U.S. Winston was a Black communist, very involved with the party, especially during the being underground during the McCarthy era, and also being the chairman during the 60s and 70s. With that, we'll continue with this conversation that Tony had. Thank you.
Tony, thank you for being here.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here, very excited to be here, and thank you to Beaverdale Books for agreeing to host this talk this evening. Just so folks know, before I jump into my presentation, Let Them Tremble is a collection of six short biographies of prominent leaders of the Communist Party USA, and it was written to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the birth of the Communist Party in 1919. My talk this evening during African American History Month is going to focus on Henry Winston, whose life is outlined in Chapter 4. Winston is perhaps one of the best known Black communists in U.S. history. However, he's also one of the least known civil rights leaders and political prisoners of the 20th century. Our story starts in July of 1948. The Mississippi-born revolutionary Henry Winston, along with most of the top leadership of the Communist Party, had recently been indicted and arrested under the provisions of the Smith Act. It was claimed that the CPUSA sought to overthrow the U.S. government by force and violence. A lengthy and costly trial followed, and it was a civil liberties farce. The government's evidence consisted of excerpts from books written decades ago, half a world away, but the Red Scare was in full swing, fueled in part by the unsubstantiated claims of paid FBI informants. At the Foley Square Courthouse in Manhattan, Winston defended his party. He said, "I am a Negro. I have experienced Jim Crow. I have seen lynchings. I have experienced segregation, brutality of every possible kind, insults and abuses, and I have always searched for a program for my people that would liberate them. And I shall never forget the fact that it was the Communist Party that was the first organization in this country to offer a program for my people as well as my class." Unlike the paid FBI informants, Winston could not be bought. He fired back at his accusers, denouncing the inquisitors and political charlatans. "We shall prove by a wealth of incontrovertible fact that Wall Street and Park Avenue control the jury system and have converted it into a conviction machine," he said. To Winston, anti-communism was an assault on the Bill of Rights, an assault on free speech and association. His warning fell on deaf ears, though. By fall 1949, Winston and his comrades had been sentenced to 5-year prison terms. The Red Scare would soon force a decade-long civil liberties retreat and cause progressive organizations like the Communist-led Civil Rights Congress, the Council on African Affairs, and the International Workers' Order to dissolve. In their place emerged groups more willing to limit their political discourse domestically and acquiesce to liberal anti-communism. Despite the growing political repression, Winston was defiant. At a March 1950 party meeting, he said, "This is a supreme test for our party. We can win this test. We can rout the enemy." Specifically, Winston was referencing the Mount Ferguson registration bill, which would have required every member of the Communist Party to register with the U.S. Attorney General's office. not only were leading communists being rounded up on false charges of conspiring to overthrow the U.S. government, now all communists, if this bill became law, would have to register based on this falsehood. According to party stalwart Arnold Johnson, Munt Ferguson would nullify the Bill of Rights, cripple the trade unions, and advance the establishment of a full-fledged fascist dictatorship. The message was clear. Civil liberties for communists would not be recognized. The McCarran Internal Security Act, which passed Congress in September 1950, further complicated matters for Winston and his comrades. McCarran Act differed from the Smith Act in that it attempted to force so-called communist front organizations to also register with federal authorities. Any organization with communists in leadership was then considered a communist front. As Winston and the party warned, democracy was in the crosshairs, not just communists. And it is in this context, with the threat of emerging domestic fascism, that the party decided in spring 1951 to send some of its core leadership, including Henry Winston, underground. It would be 5 years before anyone except Winston's most trusted comrades would see or hear from him. He reemerged in March 1956 at the Foley Square Courthouse. As he calmly walked up the courthouse steps, police rushed in from all directions, handcuffed him, and shoved him into a police car. Over 500 friends, family members, and fellow communists protested as the beleaguered revolutionary surrendered. 4 years later, 1960, Winston was now gravely ill and in anguish and pain due to years of neglect and abuse while in federal prison. According to The Worker, the party's newspaper, pure sadists capable of the most barbarian cruelties had neglected Winston's cries of pain as a tumor grew in his head. And it was only after public outcry that Winston was transferred to a prison hospital. His life was hanging by a thread. Guards waited patiently outside of his hospital room. They were ready to wrap him in chains and leg irons and haul him back to the steel and concrete tomb should the surgeons succeed in saving his life. To his comrades, the horror was bizarre, surreal even. Why was Winston treated so cruelly? He had never committed a crime against anyone. He had never hurt anyone. In fact, his entire adult life had been spent in devotion and service to the people of our land, to the workers of our nation, and to the defense of our country against Hitler. Winston had served with distinction during World War II. Maybe this was his reward now that our wartime ally, the Soviet Union, had become a feared enemy. Winston, a political prisoner in whose situation is merged the abominable credulity of American racism against the Negro people and its viciousness towards communists, embodied what I call a red-black alliance, an informal collaboration spanning decades, a collaboration many in Washington were determined to destroy. Like his friends and fellow black communists, Paul Robeson, Benjamin Davis Jr., William L. Patterson, and Claudia Jones, Winston brought the struggle for African-American equality, black liberation, and socialism together domestically and internationally. For this, he had to be punished. That Winston was both black and red apparently legitimized his tortures. By the fall of 1960, Winston had been transferred back to federal prison. Though blind, his morale was high as his comrades intensified efforts to gain his freedom. In spring 1960, Benjamin Davis Jr. put Winston's treatment in political context. He said, "Special attention must be given to the fight for the freedom of Henry Winston." To Davis, racist cruelty wasn't just directed at Winston. It was part of a larger assault against an entire people. Like the Angela Davis case roughly a decade later, Winston's struggle for freedom as a political prisoner was symbolic. Shortly thereafter, William L. Patterson toured the Soviet Union, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, France, and Great Britain to build international support for his friend. By September, the Chicago-based communist-led Afro-American Heritage Association issued a world appeal for Winston's freedom. It said, in part, Pimps, panderers, dope peddlers, and ex-public officials who steal from the public are treated with greater humanity than Winston. In late October, Winston's case was scheduled to be brought before the United Nations Human Rights Commission, where it was said he was being persecuted in the dark of his blindness and in cruel isolation from his loved ones. Apparently, the witch hunters wanted him to repent. His subversive ideas of justice and equality for his people had no place in American political discourse. Prison and blindness weren't enough. The forces of reaction, the political inquisitors, wanted contrition. Mike Newberry, in the pamphlet, The Cruel and Unusual Punishment of Henry Winston, framed this logic as thought control. Winston, a Negro leader and a communist who was convicted not of a crime, but of teaching and advocating his political philosophy, was still in jail because he would not denounce his party nor debase himself as a turncoat. The now blind revolutionary sought legal redress as well. By November, Winston had filed a $1 million lawsuit against the U.S. government, claiming that his blindness was caused by delay, negligent, and willful conduct. Trade union leader William Z. Foster said he was filled with revulsion and anger. He called Winston's treatment barbaric and added that his comrade was in jail for no crime at all. The Worker summed up the situation in fall 1960. Winston walked into prison a strong and healthy man, but because he is a Negro and a communist, the government authorities deliberately brought on his blindness by refusing to treat him. This was an obvious effort to crush him, the communist newspaper concluded. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. also supported Winston's freedom, which was a testament to the Red-Black Alliance communists had spent decades building and solidifying. In correspondence with his friend, the former communist councilman from Harlem, Benjamin Davis Jr., King wrote, "I think it is both immoral and tragic for a nation to allow any human being to face such an inhuman situation." Characteristically, King backed his words up with action. The pastor also spoke at a testimonial dinner for Winston in September 1961. 7 years later, at a Freedom Ways banquet honoring W.E.B. Du Bois, the African-American scholar, activist, and communist, King, not 6 weeks before his assassination, conversed with Winston and told him it was an honor to finally meet him. That night, King directly challenged anti-communism, noting that Du Bois was a genius and chose to be a communist. Our irrational, obsessive anti-communism has led us into too many quagmires to be retained as if it were a mode of scientific thinking, he added. Winston was undoubtedly smiling from ear to ear, as the political implications of King's comments were enormous. King wasn't the only person of note supporting Winston. Eleanor Roosevelt and A. Philip Randolph, among others, advocated for his freedom too. Perhaps inflicting another black eye on U.S.-backed international anti-communism was the goal when Fidel Castro, though still consolidating his new revolutionary government, offered to swap Winston for terrorists captured during the CIA-backed and botched Bay of Pigs invasion. In late April 1961, shortly after Winston's 50th birthday, Arnold Johnson said, "Everything about Winston calls for his freedom." Though blind, Winston and his comrades were optimistic and could see a shifting of the political winds. Their confidence proved prophetic. On June 21, 1961, President Kennedy granted Winston executive clemency. Less than a month later, Winston held a press conference. He said, "Despite my handicap, I intend to resume my part in the fight for an America and a world of peace and security, free of poverty, disease, and race discrimination. I return from prison with the unshaken conviction that the people of our great land, Negro and white, need a communist party fighting for the unity of the people, for peace, democracy, security, and socialism. I take my place in it again with deep pride. My sight is gone, but my vision remains." Increasingly, Winston and his comrades were seen as defenders of the Bill of Rights. In March 1961, 350 professors from 79 universities and colleges railed against the House Un-American Activities Committee, arguing that it had repeatedly undermined the freedoms essential for national well-being and continues to abridge citizens' rights of free speech and association. The treatment of Winston is a case in point. In August, Charles Allen Jr., National Education Director of the United Electrical Workers, a union less susceptible to anti-communism, told a rally of 1,200 people in New York City, "History has seemingly anointed the communists with the oils of struggle. They are the first to bear the brunt of repression. They are always on the front line in the everlasting struggle for the rights of man." That September, the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union, representing 200,000 people in a strategic industry, called for the abolition of HUAC, stating that the infamous committee consistently attacked only liberals and nonconformists, not truly dangerous conspirators. Cultural and civil rights leaders such as Pete Seeger and Gore Vidal, as well as the Southern Christian Leadership Council, got into the mix too. They held a massive New York City rally at the Manhattan Center that December demanding the abolition of HUAC. Despite decades of repression, communists like Henry Winston still managed to wield considerable domestic and international support, still advocated for an internationalist worldview, Marxism, Leninism, and still managed to draw tens of thousands into their orbit. Gus Hall, the party's general secretary, who was now regularly speaking in front of thousands of students on campuses across the country, wasn't wrong when he told reporters just days before Winston's release, "The attempt to jail ideas cannot succeed. Thought cannot be outlawed." Was this the real danger posed by communists like Winston? Was the treatment exacted upon him a manifestation born of fear? Fear of another generation of black luminaries like Paul Robeson and W.E.B. Du Bois, comfortably situated within the red orbit? Fear of an emerging youth and student movement, defiantly challenging McCarthy-era thought control by inviting communists to their campuses? Fear of a world in the throes of revolution, revolutions often led by communists? After spending 10 years in jail or in hiding, a prisoner in his own country, Winston, in September 1961, just as construction of the Berlin Wall was beginning, left for the Soviet Union, where he would remain until February 1964. Like many Black Americans, Henry Winston looked east for allies towards the Soviet Union and China, that he found greater opportunity, mobility, and freedom within the world of 20th century communism complicates our historical discourse on American civil rights and economic justice. Years after the collapse of socialism in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, historian Gerald Horn asked, "Who lost the Cold War?" His answer, African Americans. The battering of civil rights leaders like Henry Winston, as well as the organizations communists led, created a political vacuum filled by personalities and organizations more willing to acquiesce to liberal anti-communism, more willing to constrain their political discourse safely within the bounds of Western liberal capitalism, which clearly hasn't worked out. The assault on Black lives has not only continued unabated, it has accelerated. Perhaps this African American History Month, we would do well to remember Black communists like Henry Winston, who merged the struggle for African American equality, Black liberation, and socialism domestically and internationally. I'll end with a quote. In 1968, Henry Winston said, "The struggle for democracy is incomplete so long as discrimination exists against communists." This is an apt observation and just as relevant today as we mark the 100th anniversary of the birth of the Communist Party USA. Thank you.
Question about a couple months ago about how, like, they, you know, if I went and wanted to join the Communist Party, you know, you go onto their website, you join it, and then eventually you meet with a member, and that's how you get in. But back then, you know, there's no internet, no lots of secrecy, especially during the McCarthy era. How do you join the Communist Party when it's in that situation?
That's a really good question. you know, I'm younger than some of the other comrades here this evening. You know, I joined the party in 98, 99. And, you know, my understanding from some of the older comrades, particularly Black communists that I grew up around and who mentored me, was that there was still very much in effect during the McCarthy era, especially during the McCarthy era. You know, you had to be vouched for by numerous different comrades. And then there was all of these kind of circumvented kind of ways of how you would find out that a meeting was going on. And, you know, one of the things that I found that was really interesting in reading through the archival material, you know, was that, you know, starting in the late 1940s, early 1950s, was, you know, they stopped keeping membership lists. You know, there was no centralized list of membership. There was, you know, all of that. A lot of that documentation had been destroyed because people feared for their security and the security of their loved ones. And, you know, the part of the ramifications of the McCarran Act was also to, was the label and provision within the act, which made it so that any communist material sent through the mail had to be labeled as such, as communist material. And so you think about the, you know, the subscribers to The Worker or the subscribers to Political Affairs or, you know, Masses in the Mainstream or even at that time Monthly Review and some of the other more, you know, Marxist oriented, but not necessarily communist publications, you know, they were susceptible to the label and provisions within the act, which clearly wasn't designed to inform the person who has the subscription. It was designed to inform their neighbors.
Yeah.
And so there's all of these various security measures that were in place, you know, that tried, you know, the party tried to protect its membership, tried to protect the organizations that it worked with. And I think there's been this argument, particularly among the right wing, that, oh, the party is a secret conspiracy. Look, they don't even talk about who's a member and who's not a member. But that was largely to protect the organizations that communists helped to build. I mean, we think about in the 1960s, which is 60s and 70s and 80s is really the period in history that I'm exploring more so than the 30s, 40s and 50s. But in that time frame, you find that communists were also members of Women's Strike for Peace. Communists helped to found the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. Communists were a part of Students for a Democratic Society. There were all these other formations that were in place. The student mobilization against war in Vietnam, Bettina Apatker was very much a part of that. And then it was only during the Berkeley Free Speech Movement that she became a public communist, even though her father was well known, the historian Herbert Apatker, as a communist. And so I part of the reason why I wrote the book was because I wanted to challenge the historical narrative, the false historical narrative that the Communist Party became a marginal political force after 1956. You know, people tend to point to that year, 1956, as a defining moment in the collapse of the party because of the Khrushchev revelations, because of the suppression of the Hungarian Revolution. There had been all of these other factors, you know, then nearly a decade of political repression here domestically. A lot of historians point to 1956 as the end date, you know, as if the Communist Party ceased to exist. And my book really challenges that narrative and tries to push the story forward into the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and even into the 2000s with the work of Judith LeBlanc, for example, you know. And so, so that really challenges that narrative, and I think, despite the security challenges, back to your question, despite, you know, all of these challenges that were in place that, you know, kept party members in many instances secret, they were still very much a part of the peace movement, the student movement, you know, all these other movements in the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Yeah, and in 1982, when I joined, we had a newspaper in Des Moines called the Daily Planet. And in there were ads about join the Socialist Worker Party, join the Socialist Party, join the Communist Party. So I went, well, I'm going to go for the full dive. I'm going to just send in my request to join the Communist Party. And then, you know, I got a call back from a couple comrades. And then I met with a couple comrades. Dale was one, Tim was the other. And then they had me meet with Edna Griffin. And I met with Edna, and she said, well, tell me about yourself, Joe. And she lived over here on 44th Street. And she said, so what are you a part of now? I said, well, I'm in my union. I work at UPS and just graduated from Iowa State. and I joined the Socialist Party not too long ago, and she said, well, socialist, like, do you want to be part of something real? So she told me about her story, and I just, right after that, Tim and Dale gave me my right card, joined, start getting involved with groups like Acorn, stayed involved with my Teamsters. We had a number of union leaders who were involved in labor movement here, Peace and Freedom, got to meet Gil and Bob Crandall and others. And it was a great time, but the party was in a kind of a transitionary period too. And you had the older comrades, the first kids on the block, and then you had us younger folks, and you had formation of White Seattle. We were still dealing with the red baiting. So it was a very interesting period that then went into the 90s and changed a little bit different. But that's how some of us, we're the middle layer that I think Tony will probably have a book about of what happened with us. So.
I was going to ask another question. You kind of touched on the Gus Hall speaking to thousands of students. So you had like student free speech movements on campus. How do you see that as it relates to like the right wing free speech kind of fake-ish movement, campus movements now where they want to come and say right wing things on campus, and when they're, you know, people don't like that, they cry free speech. How do you feel about how that relates to how, you know, back in the 1960s, how the communists were like, what would you say is the difference? How would you tell somebody what the difference is?
Well, so I mean, I think one of the main differences between whatever fake or phony, you know, right-wing thing they want to make up today and the early 1960s was that the Communist Party and the youth and student movement at that time was a mass movement. It was a mass movement of millions of people. I mean, and I'll talk about this quite a bit tomorrow. You know, Gus Hall, within the span of just, I want to say 14 or 15 days in February 1962, spoke accumulatively to nearly 20,000 students. I mean, at one college, 12,000 students turned out and filled the football stadium to hear Gus Hall speak. Like, this was not a marginal political force. This was a mass movement. And it's estimated that within the first 6 months of 1962, over 50,000 students came to hear communist speakers on campuses. And then we find in the archive a letter by the Lecture and Information Bureau of the Communist Party in fall of 1962 that at that time estimated that the number had increased to nearly 75,000 students who had come to hear communist speakers within the span of 8 or 9 months. So this was a mass movement. And it was not only a mass movement, but it was a movement in defiance of over a decade of political repression. I mean, the right-wing claims of not having free speech on campuses ignores the fact that they run the business institutions, they run the classes on campus. I mean, it's really farcical on the face of it when, you know, you don't have labor studies programs, you don't have, you know, communist studies programs, but you have business studies, right? You have economics, you have all these other things that are geared towards perpetuating capitalism as if, and then for them to argue that there's not freedom of speech. I mean, who funds the and gives the grants and the endowments to all of these large universities and colleges, right?
Yeah.
Millionaires and billionaires who are bought into the capitalist system. So there's those couple of different factors that coalesce there, right? You know, not only is it not a mass movement like it was in the 60s, not only did it challenge a decade of political repression, real political repression, where people were thrown in jail because of their thoughts, mm-hmm. you know, but then you add into the mix that the schools and universities are funded by capitalists and have their own, you know, like Washington University in St. Louis, where I'm from, is a multi-billion dollar, like billion dollar institution. It's a farcical claim on the face of it. But the communists at that time, so what we find in the around 1958, 1959 was kind of a regrouping. So 1948 is when the Smith Act indictments of the top leadership of the Communist Party initiated the Red Scare, initiated McCarthyism. And then by 1958, things had begun to change quite a bit, and we begin to see a regrouping of the Communist Party. Folks that had been underground are now back above ground. Many of these laws had been challenged and had been proven to be unconstitutional by that time, though it would be years before it would become formal. But then you also begin to see a reemergence of communist youth organizations. And so by 58, 59, you have what's called the Advance Youth Organization, and you have a publication called New Horizons for Youth. And then you have in 60, 61, the Progressive Youth Organizing Committee. And then by 64, you have the birth of the W.E.B. Du Bois clubs, right? All of these were young communist formations that had thousands and thousands of members across the country on campuses who worked with, and this is another really important point here, who worked with the Committee on Racial Equality, who worked with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, who worked with Students for a Democratic Society, and were very much a part of those movements. And at that time, and still today, there was a group, in the 60s, it was called the National Student Association, and it was the largest student organization in the country. In the late 1970s, early 1980s, it merged with another number of other student groups to become the United States Student Association, which is still the largest student group in the country. And so what we found was in the early 1960s, the National Student Association was working with Advanced Youth and the Progressive Youth Organizing Committee, and later the W.E.B. Du Bois clubs, to challenge censorship on campus by inviting communists to come and speak. And then thousands of students would show up. So it's apples and oranges, really, you know, just comparing one to the other. It doesn't align with historical reality. But I'm going to go into a lot more detail about Gus Hall and that period, and probably too exhaustive of detail in the talk tomorrow. But I really felt like that period in history has been so ignored by historians, because, you know, we hear the story of SDS, we hear the story of the Weathermen, we hear the story of, you know, the alphabet soup of new left, new Marxist groups that emerged, who by FBI tallies probably had 15 real members, you know, a lot of them. But we don't hear the story of the Advanced Youth Organizing Committee. We don't hear the story of New Horizons for Youth. We don't hear the story of the W.E.B. Du Bois clubs, and later the Young Workers Liberation League. And those organizations were just as much a part of the 1960s and 1970s youth and student upsurge as SDS or the Weathermen or whatever. So.
The Civil Rights Congress was a key thing during the Civil Rights Movement, and just amazing, amazing things. But all these different groups that the party supported that really dug deep, did the hard work, and fought for, as Johnson would say, the Bill of Rights.
Yes.
On that. So yes. That's pretty amazing.
You know, one really important, you know, story that's been lost to history, you know, we hear about the Little Rock Nine, you know, the black youth that challenged segregation in Little Rock High School, or middle school. But what we don't hear is that two of the white supporters that helped to escort the Little Rock Nine into their school, two of them was Lee Lorch and his wife, and I forget her name right now, but Lee Lorch and she were both members of the Communist Party. And because of McCarthyism and Red Scare and all of that at the time, they eventually moved to Canada, and he remains active in the Canadian Communist Party until he passed a couple years ago. And so this story of Lee Lorch and the desegregation of Little Rock High is a story that's untold. And I would hope at some point somebody would go into more detail about the relationship between black civil rights and communists, primarily in the 1950s, because you have, I think, the Martinsville Seven, you have the Emmett Till murder, you have all these other things going on. You have, and I talk about this tomorrow as well, but, you know, the activists who were killed, the three youth activists who were killed in Mississippi in 64, included Schwerner, And Schwerner, his parents were New York Party members. He was a red diaper baby. That's a really important story of the ongoing contribution of communists to these various struggles. Debbie Bell and Cassie Lopez, who were youth activists in the W.E.B. Du Bois clubs at the time, worked full-time for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the early 60s while they were communists. And so there's all of these kind of intertangled stories between the organizations that are the more prominent, more well-known civil rights organizations, and how communists were very much a part of that movement as well.
It definitely surprising, like, the longer I'm on the left, like, learning, you know, different people. Like, I think a popular one for my generation to find out is Tupac. Like, finding out he was in the YCL, you know? I mean, and finding out his aunt's, you know, Asada's history, and his mom's history in the Black Panther Party, and, you know, or MLK, learning that, you know, because as kids, we're taught about MLK's dream speech, and that's it. It stops there. But you don't hear about his economic opinions, and you don't hear about, like, the communists that were kind of around him and in his circle. So,
well, very interesting story. So King's father and Benjamin Davis's father, Benjamin Davis, the Harlem councilman, Harlem communist councilman, were both raised in Atlanta, Georgia. King's father and Davis's father were very close friends in the Republican Party. And mind you, the Republican Party was the party of abolition still at that time, right? So they were leaders in the Atlanta Republican Party. And Benjamin Davis Jr. and King Jr. remained friends throughout their entire adult life. And in the early 1960s, when King was in New York and was stabbed and rushed to the hospital and had to get a blood transfusion, it was none other than Benjamin Davis Jr. who rushed to the hospital to provide blood. Just a piece of history that illustrates the close ties between these two different civil rights leaders who, you know, King, there's a lot of quotes, you know, King distanced himself from communism and the Communist Party, but he was very much a socialist. And you know, in correspondence back and forth between King and Benjamin Davis Jr., he will note that they, obviously we don't agree on everything, but I can respect you and respect the work that you and your party are doing. Where is that story?
Yeah.
Why isn't that being told? The only place that I've found that story is in Gerald Horn's biography of Benjamin Davis Jr., which was published 25 years ago, maybe 30 years ago. But that's the only place I've found that story. And it's been completely ignored by mainstream historiography, is the links between Benjamin Davis Jr. and King Jr. But it's a very important story.
Yeah, it cracks me up when Republicans are like, yeah, Martin Luther King definitely would have been a Republican. Are you sure?
Let me show you one of his later speeches. Yeah. Do you have any opinion at all if J. Edgar Hoover knew some of these connections, or was he just paranoid?
I mean, when you look at the, and there's been a couple of good books written about the, you know, use of internal security apparatus, the emergence of COINTELPRO and all of that. When you look at that and read those books, you find that there was quite a bit of surveillance, quite a bit of infiltration, quite a bit of, you know, knowledge of, for example, you know, Jack O'Dell and his relationship to the Communist Party, and King, Stanley Levison and his relationship to the Communist Party and King. But I don't think the grand leap that Hoover is trying to make, I don't think exists. You know, King, again, in his correspondence with Davis Jr., was very clear about, you know, I share many of your same beliefs and values, but we diverge, you know, in these regards. So yeah, I mean, it's at one point in time, the FBI probably had in the ballpark of 1,200 to 1,300 informants just in the Communist Party, and infiltrators. You know, and part of the reason why I made the comment earlier about some of the other new left, new Marxist groups only having 15 or 20 members or whatever, is because half of them were FBI informants. And they were reporting on each other and trying to recruit each other into the FBI. And then you read through these FOIA, Freedom Information Act files, you find this really hilarious kind of set of circumstances where a FBI informant is informing on the other FBI informant, not knowing that like half of the cadre of the Maoist whatever group were all FBI members. And so it's kind of hilarious in hindsight. I'm sure it wasn't funny at the time, but anyways, I mentioned that to say that I think it was known that there were relationships, you know, but I wouldn't make the grand leap, you know, I wouldn't make that grand leap. Evidence doesn't justify that type of leap.
And thank you everyone for listening today. Hope you enjoyed this conversation with Tony Pesanovsky. And if you're interested in his book, you can purchase it at International Publishers. The website link is intpubnyc.com. Once again, it's intpubnyc.com. And that's International Publishers in New York. And his book is available for about $20 on the website. Thank you all for listening. And if you enjoyed this conversation, please leave a review if you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Or you can also post on our party website at cpusa.org. All right. Thank you, everyone.